All right, so today we're just going to focus directly on Athanasius. We talked about the council last week, and we had to talk about Athanasius quite a bit just because he's involved. But I'm going to try and tell the life story of Athanasius in one go here. That's the plan. So he was born at the start of the 4th century, which means his earliest childhood memories would have been formed in the context of Diocletian's persecution. He would have had childhood memories. We don't know exactly what those memories would have been, but that's the context in which he grew up. He grew up speaking Coptic, which was the Egyptian language, and he was also educated to some degree, we're not totally sure, in Greek literature. He was a precocious young man who soon attracted the attention of the bishop, and at about 20 years of age, he was ordained as a deacon and fulfilled that office by serving as the personal secretary of the bishop, who you'll remember his name is Alexander, Bishop of Alexandria. Athanasius was almost 30 when he accompanied Alexander to the council at Nicaea, and less than a year after the council, I think it was something like 5 months after the council, Alexander died, and Athanasius was chosen to succeed him, with some concern about his age. There was a bit of a kerfuffle and a bit of a delay in his election. He was only about 30 years old, and there were some rules saying you had to be 35 or something like that. But no doubt about it, 30 is pretty young to become the Bishop of Alexandria, which was the most prominent leadership position in the church at that time. He remained in that office for about 45 years until his death in 373. So it's really a era-defining ministry. His first work of theology, at least the first one we have, was probably written in the late 330s, so about 10 years after the council. It's a two-part work called Against the Gentiles, and then the second part is called On the Incarnation. It's available in a very nice little paperback with an introduction by C.S. Lewis. You can find that's good reading. Just to give you a taste of it, here's a little excerpt from Athanasius on the reason that the Word, meaning the Son, became human. The Word, realizing that in no other way would the corruption of human beings be undone except by dying, yet being immortal and the Son of the Father, was not able to die. For this reason, he takes to himself a body capable of death in order that it, participating in the Word who is above all, might be sufficient for death on behalf of all, and through the indwelling Word would remain incorruptible. And so corruption might henceforth cease from all by the grace of resurrection. You can see in that little excerpt that there's a lot of gospel significance to this question of who Jesus is. Is he God or is he not? If he is God, then his act of taking a human nature has this, there's this logic to it, that he couldn't die unless he took a human nature, but if he did take a human nature, then he, being God, could accomplish something divine through it. And that's a little glimpse of Athanasius at work theologically. Here's another little quote on the resurrection, proving the resurrection. He says, "The Savior is working mightily among men every day as he invisibly persuades all numbers of people over all the world, both within and beyond the Greek-speaking world, to accept his faith and be obedient to his teaching. Can anyone, in face of this, still doubt that he has risen and lives, or rather that he is himself the life? Does a dead man prick the consciences of men?" That's quite a question. I was thinking to myself, you know that hymn, I actually really don't like it, but I have to confess, maybe there's something to it. You ask me how I know he lives within my heart. I think that's classic 19th century sentimental liberalism, but Athanasius gives the sort of based version of it here. Like, can a dead man prick the consciences of men? That I could sing without any hint of concern. So Constantine died in 337, and he divided his empire among his three sons, who, as we said, were very originally named Constantine II, Constantius II, and Constans. Bill, Billy, and William, you know. These men, they didn't really get along. They were brothers, you know, and you know how brothers are. And basically, they fought among themselves. It's like normal brothers fight about, like, who gets the car today, that kind of thing. These brothers were, like, fighting over who gets which part of the empire and stuff like that. They were on a different scale. But at any rate, to make a long story short, during the 340s, there was a lot of conflict between them and a lot of things changing. And they each had different attitudes towards the controversies relevant to Athanasius and the church. There's honestly a lot of details that I just can't summarize accurately in short enough time. But in 350, Constantius gained supremacy. He was now the only emperor because one of his brothers had been defeated, another died. They were both dead by the 350s. So for a full decade, Constantius had supremacy in the empire, and he was a great supporter of the Arian bishops. In 361, when Constantine died, his nephew Julian came to the throne. Julian was a brilliant man who loved Greek culture and old Roman order. And he did his best to turn the empire away from Christianity and back to ancient paganism. He's known as Julian the Apostate to history because he was the one who personally apostatized. He left Christian faith and went back to paganism. He attempted to make the empire do the same. He only lived a few short years, though, and he died in battle with the Persians and was succeeded by two more emperors with brief reigns, Jovian, who was sympathetic to Athanasius, and then Valens, who was an Arian. And my point in giving that quick summary is just to say that all those emperors came and went during Athanasius' ministry. 45 years as a bishop, Athanasius spent 17 years in exile on 5 separate occasions as all these changes kept going back and forth. In the 330s, Constantine sent him to Germany for a year. So he actually spent a year in Germany, which for an Egyptian might have been quite wet and cold, I'm guessing. In the 340s, Constantius banished him to Rome for 7 years. That was actually a pretty important period in Athanasius' life, where he spent time in Rome connecting with different church leaders and writing. In the 350s, he fled to the Egyptian desert, where he lived with the monks for 6 years, which also was another important phase in his ministry, especially developing some of his spiritual writings and connecting with what you might call sort of the local people in Egypt. In the 360s, he had 2 more short exiles before finally spending the last 7 years of his life in Alexandria without interruption, his golden years, 7 years at the end. Now, the emperors remained involved in church politics this whole time. They kept calling councils, and the councils kept discussing the Nicene language of homoousios and these other issues related to it. The emperor most interested in shaping Christian doctrine was Constantius. And of course, and as I mentioned, he came to rule in the 350s. And he was really willing to use his political power to settle this question. His preferred solution was what a scholar named Richard Hansen called an innocuous but vague doctrine focused on the term homoios, similar. So he didn't like people saying ousia, substance. This was like too specific. And he also didn't like the word same. He wanted this more general term, similar. And at that time, Constantius's preferred approach was the leading option among the bishops in the East, at least. To give you a couple specific episodes in this whole area, in the year 355, Constantius called a small council in Milan in northern Italy with the goal of convincing the Western churches to join the Eastern bishops in denouncing Athanasius and accepting his vague Homoian doctrine. The bishops initially objected, but under threat of exile, Constantius got them to comply. And later, Athanasius gave this account of the council. When people objected to Constantius's demands and said, "This is not the church's rule," in reply, he said, "But what I wish, that must be the rule. When I said this, those who were called the bishops of Syria allowed it. So now either give in or you will be exiled." And then Athanasius adds that the bishops at the time warned Constantius not to destroy the customs of the church, nor to confuse the government of the Roman Empire with the ordering of the church. Quite a thing to say to the imperial person. In the year 357, Constantius orchestrated another general council, which he meant as a way to definitively move on from the legacy of Nicaea. Various forms of imperial pressure succeeded in producing a creed that fit the Arian doctrine. At the key point, the Son was described as only like the Father. That was the key point in this creed at Sirmium, which is where this council was held. Sirmium is in modern-day Croatia, if I remember correctly. At the end of the creed, it condemns Nicaea's ousia language specifically. Here's what it says. "The word ousia, which was simplistically put down by the fathers, being unknown to the people, has become a scandal because the scriptures do not contain it. We have all decided it should be removed and that there should be absolutely no mention of it at all, since the Holy Scriptures never mention the ousia of the Father and the Son. But we say that the Son is like the Father, as the Holy Scriptures say and teach. So you can see some of those objections that we talked about last week, that if this term's not in the Bible, then you can't use it. That was one of the big issues here. Now, if you're understanding what's going on, as we have sort of seen the context, you got to understand the point of that was specifically to prohibit Nicene Orthodoxy and promote Arianism. That's what that statement meant. For that reason, it became known to history as the blasphemy of Sirmium. That's how this creed is remembered. There's a famous quote from Saint Jerome, who wrote about this episode. And he said that at that point, the whole world groaned and was astonished to find itself Arian, because this like official imperial policy was sort of rammed through at the highest level. But it wasn't like all Christians changed their beliefs to become Arian. It was just that like the sort of international church council had issued this blasphemy of Sirmium. And anyways, Jerome's quote is famously vivid. The whole world groaned and was astonished to find itself Arian. Various leading Arian bishops at this point started deposing those who were faithful to Nicaea and promoting bishops who were even more radical in their errors. And these were the years that Athanasius had to spend 6 years in exile in Egypt with the monks. Now, mentioning the monks gives me a little chance to share something about Athanasius' spiritual life. It would be a mistake to think Athanasius was always just arguing with people about ousia this and ousia that. That wouldn't be right at all. So just to give you a glimpse of another side of his life and ministry, here is one of my favorite writings of his, which was probably composed during this period that he spent in the Egyptian desert. It's a letter to a man named Marcellinus on the Psalms, and it is a masterful reflection on the Christ-centered meaning of the Psalms and of their meaning for the Christian life. And I say, as you read it, you really get a sense of the deep biblical piety that Athanasius had, his love for Christ, and you can start to see how he had the spiritual strength to go on year after year, decade after decade in the hard ministry that he was assigned. Here's a paragraph from this. It's kind of a longer, it's probably about 30 or 40 pages long. I'll just give you one paragraph. If you want to sing psalms that speak especially about the Savior, you will find something in almost all of them. But Psalm 45 and Psalm 110 relate particularly to his divine begetting from the Father and his coming in the flesh. While Psalm 22 and Psalm 69 foretell the Holy Cross, the grievous plots he bore, and how great things he suffered for our sakes. I'll just pause there. A couple people noticed when Pastor Mark a few weeks ago shared the connection where Jesus in Psalm 69 spoke about how he had no one was there to comfort him. Right, that's Psalm 69. That's the connection there. The grievous plots he bore and how great things he suffered for our sakes. Psalm 4 and Psalm 109 display the snares and malice of the Jews and how Iscariot betrayed him. Psalm 21, Psalm 50, and Psalm 72 all set him forth as judge and foretell his second coming in the flesh to us. They also show the Gentiles' call. Psalm 16 shows his resurrection from the dead in the flesh. The 24th Psalm and the 47th show his ascension into heaven. And in the four Psalms, 93, 96, 98, and 99, all the benefits deriving to us from the Savior's passion are set together. Now, that work goes on like this for just page after page after page. You know, if somebody's getting baptized, here's a great psalm to sing. If somebody's lying about you, try singing this psalm. If somebody's leaving the faith, sing this psalm. If you've got enemies at the door, sing this psalm. It's an incredible reflection on the way that the psalms are well fitted to help Christians live for Christ in love for him. So I recommend it to you. I wish I had more time to read it here together, but maybe another day. I want to talk a little bit more about Constantius specifically. He offers a really important lesson about the church's relationship to political leaders. If we think back a couple emperors, you think about Diocletian and his persecution, and that makes us really grateful for Constantine and his conversion to Christ and the end of the persecution and the way that he helped the church, including by calling the Council of Nicaea. Nevertheless, it would be important to understand that Constantine himself was not a steady guide to the church, theologically. He frequently shifted between sympathy towards Eusebius, who was generally more of an Arian bishop, and Athanasius, who was, of course, an anti-Arian bishop. And during Constantine's reign, you know, the church was really unsettled. It was shifting in different directions, partly because Constantine himself was shifting in different directions. And there was these strong personalities and not a lot of clear theological guidance available from the emperor. If you had thought to yourself, oh, now the emperor is Christian, he'll tell us what to do, that would be clearly very inadequate attitude. Constantine would not be a good pastor, actually. Now, his son Constantius was a threat to the church, much more than Constantine was, but in a very different way than Diocletian had been. And it's important to notice, persecution is not the only way that political leaders can harm the church. Like his father, Constantius supported the church and called councils. But whereas Constantine had given church leaders freedom to work out their doctrinal differences, generally, Constantius, he offered support in a very selective and strategic way. For instance, in the year 356, he forced Athanasius into exile, and when he did that, he was acting on the advice of other bishops who disagreed with Athanasius. And he appointed another bishop, a man named George of Cappadocia, who was an Arian. So a neutral observer might think that he was more supportive to the church than Diocletian had been because he was providing the church with a bishop. Here's this guy, George, right? But the very act of getting George into office was actually a harm to the church because he was interfering with true doctrine and installing his preferred error. George, by the way, is a very miserable character because people in Alexandria really didn't like him. They ended up murdering him. And that's one of the episodes that sometimes gets blamed on Athanasius. And it's, I said a couple weeks ago, it's not totally clear to me how to evaluate that. It's hard to tell. Was Athanasius in favor of that murder, or was he just one of the personalities involved in a tumultuous situation? I don't actually know enough to settle that question. Nobody claims that Athanasius directly ordered his murder. That's not a claim, but there's various other insinuations that Athanasius was kind of a gangster, but I personally am not sympathetic to them. The point is that Constantius's policy was not persecution in the normal sense of the term. It was a way of making life easy for some church leaders and hard for others. And if you know a bit about history, you'll recognize this as a pattern. For instance, the Soviets did this. They didn't just shut down all churches. They shut down a lot of churches, but they actually made life better and easier for pastors who were willing to write favorable opinion pieces in the local newspaper and stuff like that. And they would get like a regular weekly column, and you know, they get invited to the, you know, the breakfasts with the local mayor or whatever, and it would be like life would be a little better for them. And so it would keep them from being so obviously persecutors, so it would kind of tone down people's concerns about their interference. But it would still accomplish their goal of essentially gaining complete dominance over the church. The Chinese Communist Party does something similar today with like the government-approved churches and so on. So anyway, it's a pattern that we should be able to recognize. Even in England, like Queen Elizabeth had preachers that she wouldn't, you know, she didn't shut down all preaching, but she did have licenses for who could preach. So you gotta be a little bit more savvy than just if they're totally murdering all Christians, then they're persecutors. And if they're doing anything else, then they're favorable to the church. That's much too simplistic. My point is, Constantius is a really good example of someone that we have to be very discerning. What's he doing? Is he supporting the church by calling these councils? Or is he actually harming the church by using his influence to promote an agenda that's contrary to the truth? And that kind of savvy discernment is really important here. There are people, especially today, who are inclined to learn a very simple lesson from this episode. And their conclusion is there should be no such thing ever as a Christian emperor or a Christian politician. The church should always seek to go it alone without any support from the magistrate. And if support is offered, the church should decline it. And the church should never aim to influence mainstream political life in order to extend the reign of Christ. Some people do take that lesson from all this. They say, look, you just can't trust an emperor. They might help in some ways, but they're going to hurt in others, so just stay away, right? Now, in the 16th century in Europe, that was the position of the Anabaptists. These days, it is the position of many, actually even in Reformed churches, who can frequently be heard denouncing, and you know, this is one of those terms, you say this term out loud, and everyone looks up and wonders suddenly what you think. But you can hear these people, and often they're denouncing Christian nationalism. They'll say, oh, I'm against Christian nationalism. But what we need to understand is that if Athanasius and his friends had taken this view, that there's no proper role for the magistrate or for the public role of the church in the life of the empire, if they took that Anabaptist view of things, well, what they would have done is they would have gone into exile and stayed there and never come back, right? They would have just stayed away from all interactions with emperors and politicians. They would have joined the monks completely. Thankfully, I think, they did not take that approach. Neither did the reformers. And that's why the Westminster Assembly said in chapter 23 of the Confession that the magistrate has power to call synods, to be present at them, and to provide that whatsoever is transacted in them be according to the mind of God. That's what the Assembly said in 1647 about the magistrate, that the magistrate has the role of making sure that what the church decides is according to the mind of God. Wow. What they're doing there is basically summarizing Constantine's approach. They're approving of it and saying that's the right approach. Now, some of you will know that the American Presbyterian churches revised this section of the Confession in the 18th century, and you may be relieved, thinking, wow, I didn't realize our church had this in its confession. And so maybe you'll be glad to know that the Americans revised this, and they dialed it back to reflect that there was no established church at the federal level in the new American Republic. Even so, the revised version of the Westminster Standards calls the magistrates nursing fathers, which is applying the language of Isaiah, who are bound to protect the church of our common Lord without giving preference to any denomination of Christians above the rest. And there's some current discussion about this going on. The PCA has a study committee on Christian nationalism that's happening. So this is a big question on people's minds. But I'll just point out, even the revised version of the Confession still says that the magistrate is to support the church. And it says it's not to support one denomination of Christians above the rest, but it is not, I believe, expressing a kind of secular idea that the magistrate should have no concern for religion. And for instance, I don't think the Confession, the American version, is saying that the magistrate should stay out of disputes between Muslims, Buddhists, and Christians. I think the American version of the Confession is pretty clearly saying that the magistrate should take care to promote the Christian church. And the secular idea that it's all religions, the magistrate needs to sort of transcend the dispute between all religions, I don't think the American version of the Confession agrees with that. My point for now is that this view that the magistrate is supposed to care for the church, protect the church of our common Lord without giving preference to any denomination of Christians above the rest, that's pretty much Constantine's approach in the 330s. It is not Constantius's approach in the 350s, and it's helpful to our discernment to see the difference. Constantine was not a steady guy theologically. He was not a great theologian, not a great theological mind. If you'd gone to him asking for theological guidance, it'd be a little bit like going to, Mike Pence. Mike Pence, could you help me with a deep exegetical question? And you know, 50-50 chance Mike Pence will give you a good answer. I don't know, he's fine. But it's not like Mike Pence is an expert, right? That's Constantine, something like that. Constantius is more like what I would say, I would just say Joe Biden did this in his inaugural speech, where he said, you know, Augustine was a saint of my church, and he said that we're all to have common love, and everything's about love. And then he sort of parlayed that into a very secular, atheist vision of just love for everybody, without any reference to what Augustine or the Catholic Church actually teaches about anything, right? I would say that's a much more subversive way to use church connections, and it's much more like what Constantius is doing, where he's using his church background and his influence in the church for a positively untruthful agenda. Now, I'll also point out that the Confession gives us good language to describe and reject Constantius's bad behavior. The original version of the Confession says that the civil magistrate may not assume to himself the administration of the word and sacraments or the powers of the keys of the kingdom of heaven. That is exactly what Constantius did when he co-opted bishops to force them to issue a creed to his liking. He took over the ministry of the word in that way. He also basically caused his least favorite bishops to be deposed, which means that he was running church discipline cases, which is the magistrate exercising the keys of the kingdom. The American Revised Version of the Confession says that all ecclesiastical persons, whatever, shall enjoy the full, free, unquestioned liberty of discharging every part of their sacred functions without violence or danger. Again, that is not what Constantius was doing when he sent Athanasius into exile, right? So my point in saying this is that we don't have to choose between a kind of scary Christian nationalism where the emperor runs everything, and then secularism, where the emperor has no influence. Those are not the only two options. In one way, Constantius is option one, and our sort of modern views are the other. There's also the option of Constantine, of having somebody who exercises the proper role for a political magistrate, leaving the church to do its proper thing. And it always takes some discernment about how that works. Nobody's going to be... certainly, Constantine had his flaws, but he's at least much closer to the ideal that's represented in our standards. Another thing that the American version says is that no law of any commonwealth should interfere with the due exercise of religion among the voluntary members of any denomination of Christians according to their own profession and belief. So that, you can see, is such a good description of Constantine, saying, we're going to call this council. You guys are going to hash out what's the biblical doctrine concerning the sun. I'm going to be up at the front starting things dressed in gold, and I'll pay for your meals, and you can stay at my nice hotels. But it wasn't like Constantine was picking and choosing the winners and losers. Constantius was picking and choosing the winners and losers, and it's a very important difference. So my thesis, if I hope I've been somewhat clear in making this, describing this perspective, my argument would be that we should not conclude that there should be no such thing as a Christian emperor or politician. That's just too simplistic. That Anabaptist position is just too simplistic and not real. A better conclusion is that Christians need to be discerning when their political leaders support the church. We just need to be discerning about this and make sure we understand what's going on. While we call on the magistrate to serve Christ by promoting true religion and public righteousness, we must remain ready to forego the magistrate's approval and assistance when faithfulness to Christ demands it. Constantius shows how difficult this can be and how confusing these things can be, and Athanasius sets us a model of tenacity and shrewdness in this. He really was very dogged in his efforts to lead the church faithfully in this area. I'm getting really spicy today. I have examples. I have modern examples. Let me just give you two examples of where I think we need discernment. And I picked one, shall we say, on the right and one on the left, because I think in all sorts of areas we need this discernment. When President Trump promotes in vitro fertilization, I'd say this is an area where Christians need to be really ready to say, thank you for your judges who helped us strike down Roe v. Wade, but we are not going to kill embryos either, right? That's a very important example of we need to be discerning and not just think, oh, he's our guy, so we'll do whatever he wants, right? So that's one example. Another example I mentioned quickly last week, because I had just seen it online, and I went back and got the quotes and everything. There's a Quebec politician, his name is Mark Miller. He went to school with Justin Trudeau at a very fancy prep school in Montreal. And he made this, and he, being Justin Trudeau's like high school buddy, he's like quite an influential politician now in Canada. And he made this statement in a parliamentary committee a couple weeks ago saying that there are hateful messages in the Bible specifically against homosexuals, and anybody who commits a hate crime and then tries to argue that they were just reading the Bible, that defense should be dismissed, okay? And then when he was criticized, he responded by saying, look, I say this because I'm a Christian. That's what he said. My mom's United or Anglican, depending on who's on the organ, and my dad was a padre in the Air Force. And my point is that he's a lot like Constantius, right? It's not like a totally non-Christian guy coming in and threatening the church with just mayhem, But he is going to select who's going to be able to make what types of arguments, which Bible verses are going to be, you know, sort of approved. I'll quote you the ones about love, and that'll have the full backing of the government, and you'll have to try and stand out there alone at the press conference while everyone's throwing stuff at you and argue that you can quote from Leviticus, right? He's like really using state and social pressure to make sure nobody would ever feel safe saying this, because they're going to get accused of being a hate crime. He's essentially opening the door to prosecutors in the government, just unleashing their offices against anybody who quotes from Scripture in those parts with a straight face, right? It's a pretty serious ploy at government intervention in the church. But under the cover of, well, I say it because I'm a Christian, my mom's United or Anglican, depending on who's on the organ. I mean, the Twitter comments back were awesome. It's like, United Church, that's not Christian, man. So somebody in Canada still got it. So anyways, Constantius, I think it's actually good a good episode to study to try and update our discernment. And anyways, I've shared a couple other examples, and maybe we could talk more about different examples another time. Now, I want to go back to this council at 357 that issued the blasphemy of Sirmium, okay? It seemed like the Arians were winning, because the emperor and the bishops had all agreed, we're getting rid of this homoousios language, and we're going to officially establish this policy of homoios, or homoian doctrine, and that's that. And it really looked like everybody was winning. But the blasphemy of Sirmium had an ironic effect. One of its major effects was to expose fault lines that had been running under the surface of all the confusing terminologies of the last couple of decades. There were so many different like flavors of ice cream, so to speak, about all the different ways of describing the doctrine of the Trinity. And at the Council of Sirmium, when the Arians like won their victory, it actually became clearer. The people who were in favor of this, whatever differences they seem to have, actually their agreement with Sirmium unites them. And then the people who were against it, whatever differences there may be between them, their objections to Sirmium unite them. And actually what began to happen is that two clear sides emerged. And these are the sides that we now, with historical hindsight, can much more easily call the Arians and the Nicenes. But it was not that easy to understand this back in the 340s and 350s when everything was being discussed. So Athanasius and his allies were firm defenders of Nicaea. They rejected Sirmium. Some people basically agreed with him, although they didn't like the term homoousios. They preferred homoiousios, similar, but they kind of got over that problem. And then there was the radical Arians, who even said the Son is not even similar to the Father. He's dissimilar to the Father. They were like that radical about it. And then there was the whole mushy middle that was just like, yes, sir, Constantius, we'll do whatever you want. And they all wanted the kind of vague Arianism of Sirmium. And these two sides suddenly formed in a way that hadn't been the case in the previous decades. And so the blasphemy of Sirmium actually helped organize these different strands into these two more obvious sides. And the key issue was that one side believed that the Son shares the same being as the Father. The other side said that the Father created the Son, choosing to have a Son by his will. That's the big difference. And there's a hopeful lesson, I think, for the church there. We might think in the middle of our pressures and perplexities and all the confusions, we look around, oh man, everything's in disarray, that, you know, the bad guys are winning in various ways. If you could speak with a Christian in Alexandria during this time, he would probably tell you, you know, there's soldiers surrounding the churches, you know, the Sirmium Creed just won, things are going really badly, we're about to lose. Perhaps if we could reply, we could tell our friend in the mid-4th century, with more historical perspective, it's actually easier to see how God was using all that confusion and the reversals to make an important step towards the clarity of the triumph of orthodoxy at the Council of Constantinople. So what exactly implications of that might be for interpreting our perspective are, I can't say, but maybe in 30 or 40 years, I'll be able to look back at this period and say, ah, I see what God was doing. He was helping us arrive at the conclusion that we needed to arrive at.